Welcome to Defense Unicorns, a podcast for mission-focused innovators. We educate, inform, and provide mission heroes with DevSecOps, cybersecurity, and organizational transformation stories from the world's leading problem solvers. I'm your host, Rebecca Lively, and we are so excited for you to join us on this journey. Today, I'm joined by Captain Will Walker. He is the Chief Disruption Officer at the 90th Cyberspace Operations Squadron. And I'm super excited to have him on. He has been disrupting all sorts of things in my presence and outside my presence for well over a year. And I think his is a voice that I'm really excited to bring to the podcast. So with that, introduce yourself and give some highlights of your career and how you got to where you are.
Yeah, for sure. Thanks so much, Rebecca, for having me. Yeah, I've been in the Air Force now just about 4 years. I just pinned on captain actually today. And I've been really enjoying my time currently at the 90th Cyberspace Operations Squadron, where we're doing software development in support of U.S. Cyber Command. Yeah, I commissioned from University of Delaware way back in 2020. Seems like eons ago, but really wasn't that long ago. And I was drawn to the Air Force ROTC program at the University of Delaware, really because of their scholarship program. As a high school student, I didn't really know how I was going to pay for college. I didn't really know what I wanted to study in college. I've always tinkered around with computers as like a high school student, but didn't really know what I wanted to study. Found out that the computer science program at University of Delaware was really cool. They have a lot of cool things that they specialize in, have a really hands-on approach for doing software development as one of their focuses in the curriculum. And so, yeah, I was just trying to wrestle with how do I end up paying for school with it being so expensive, even in-state tuition. It's pretty pricey. And so, I found out about ROTC and thought, man, this would be a sweet deal to try to get my school paid for and to try it out. We had this thing called the freshman option, where even if you got a scholarship, you could renege after your first year. So at the worst case, I guess I was getting a free year of college for the first year if I got a scholarship, and was very thankful that I got a scholarship with ROTC. And then fast forward a few years, getting closer to graduation, really loving the comp sci thing, but trying to thread that needle or basically try to get that opportunity where I could continue doing technical work as an officer, realizing those things are in a juxtaposition. I kept getting told no, like you can't be a software developer. We have this thing called cyber, but you've probably never heard that word because nobody else really uses that word. And it's true. I have friends in industry and sometimes it'll come up in conversation and it's just weird even saying the word cyber. So yeah, I commissioned in 2020 as a cyber warfare officer. But I actually took a little detour and was up in Boston, Massachusetts for a year. I had applied for a program called Gold Bar Diversity Recruiting, which is where they take 20 to 30 newly fresh commissioned lieutenant butter bars and sprinkle them throughout the U.S. and co-locate them with an Air Force ROTC detachment at a university. Mine was with DET 355 up in Boston. And we just are basically given free rein to go and share our experiences about ROTC with no real quota, which is nice because we're basically just sharing information and meeting high school students and college counselors and whatnot. And so I really enjoyed my time up there. But it's during that time I actually started to meet some of the folks at Kessel Run and Platform One and starting to realize, man, there's a huge kind of movement in the Air Force, in the military, but in the Air Force specifically, these software factories starting to materialize across the U.S. How do I end up there? So that was in the back of my mind in the early 2020s and 2021, thinking about, I really want to stay technical and can continue on as an individual contributor, but also recognizing that as an officer, that's going to be a hard thing to do. So I got closer to the end of my assignment. It was just a year there in Boston and was slated to go do tech school at Biloxi at Keesler Air Force Base in Mississippi there, and arrived on the scene. Didn't know much of the quote-unquote the real Air Force. Now we're getting closer. Tech school's still not the real Air Force, but certainly one step above the Gold Bar recruiting experience during COVID. And showing up there at tech school, asking the same questions, like how do I end up at a squadron or at a unit or a detachment or whatever it needs to be in order for me to contribute and do the thing that I love, which is software development. And I finally was able to make a connection with our DO at the time, Major Hunter, and she pulled me aside and was like, look, if this is something you really want to do, there are squadrons like the 90th Cyberspace Operations Squadron. Have you heard of them? And I was like, no. She said, there are squadrons that are working on some really cool stuff that are actually contributing to missions is that something you'd want to do? Like, sure, how do we get there? And she made a connection, who made a connection, and how these things go. Eventually, I graduated from tech school in 2022 and ended up at the 90th, and I've been here ever since, and I've loved it. It's been great.
That's fantastic. So I have two questions out of that. So the first is, you joined the Air Force for the scholarship opportunity, which I think a lot of folks do. Do you have any family members who've been in the Air Force or anything, or was your family, whoa, this is out of left field?
It wasn't out of left field. Neither of my parents served in the military. My grandfather on my dad's side was in training as a navigator and was basically like right about to be stationed downrange in World War II, but then the war was over. So we got some cool pictures of him and stuff on his uniform and the aircraft that he was going to be a navigator for, but he never actually got to see anything overseas. So I think my dad, knowing that my grandfather enjoyed like preparing for this and kind of the structure and the formality and the opportunity to wear the uniform and to like, you know, serve your country, all that goodness was never really materialized. But I think my grandfather spoke highly of it. And my father was really instrumental in just, I guess, suggesting or prompting me to check this out, encouraging me to check it out. And I'm really thankful that he did, because it was nothing like I'd ever experienced growing up. I didn't do junior ROTC or, yeah, like I said, neither of my parents actually served in the military. Getting the opportunity to experience it in college and then now on active duty for 4 years has been really awesome.
Oh, that's awesome. The other thing you said, software factory, and that's a phrase that I hear a lot and I'm very familiar with, but I know a lot of software developers hear that phrase and they don't know what that means. So I'm curious, what does that phrase mean to you?
That's a great question. I've never really been able to nail that one down, to be completely honest. I hear the word software factory and I think of a unit that's producing multiple value streams of software. So they're shipping software, right? Like a factory producing chairs or glasses or whatever, there's this thing and it's a constituent of contractors and civilians and active duty members wearing the uniform all together, just working cohesively to ship software out the door. I don't know if that term, I guess we go back and forth whether that term applies here to the 90th, because we're a little bit different in that we're contributing to the mission for U.S. Cyber Command, but we're certainly at the end of the day producing some artifact that's getting used in missions. And so, yeah, I think that description of a factory is just, I don't really know where that comes from. I'd be curious to dig into the history of who coined the term.
And for our listeners, I'm certain that there is a good answer out there somewhere, and I don't have it either. So we get to make it up, which is fantastic. I know a lot of officers are expected, I think almost immediately out of tech school, to lead people. And I think by captain, I've known a lot of officers who lead like, you know, up to 40 or more people. Have you had to do that in your role, or have you been able to be more of a technical contributor?
Yeah, I've never been anybody's raider. I've never looked at another person OPR or an EPR for that matter. Yeah, but you're right. Like, that's what I was mentally preparing for as a senior in college. Like, that's the bulk of whatever we, you know, the experiences we heard from the active duty officers in our detachment, basically telling us and preparing us mentally for that experience. But I think I've definitely seen that in the units that I've been stationed with. There are, like, even in the 90th, right, there are officers who are fulfilling that function as kind of leaders and managers. But I've never actually served in a position where those have been my day-to-day responsibilities.
And what's interesting is I think when we worked together prior to my leaving and taking over this podcast, among other things, and I found you to be one of the best leaders that I know. And what I think is really interesting about that is you just told me you've never supervised anyone. So I'm curious, what does leadership mean to you when you're technical?
That's a good question. That's a tough question. Maybe I'll just like try to dissect that and pick apart the first piece, like what is leadership? I really even hesitate to bring this up because this is taboo to bring this up about your ROTC experience. And so I was certainly never at anybody's radar, but had leadership positions in ROTC, of course. And I made the mistake as a college student that the position I was in afforded me the ability to just dictate what others should be doing. I learned that lesson like pretty quickly. That's just not how things work. The position does not automatically give you a lot of the things I think are necessary in order to be an effective leader. So what I'm not trying to say is that if someone's in the position of squadron command or group command or wing command, that they have to quote unquote earn those things once they're in the seat. They have, right? And that's why they're appointed to that position. And so that the position is deserving of respect and certainly recognize that. But there's so much that's wrapped up also in the person who's fulfilling that position. And I think in order to be truly effective, there are a lot of qualities and traits that you can honestly develop irregardless of your position, your official position. And so I think any luck that I've had up until this point of leading from the trenches, maybe you might say, being down in the weeds technical at the tactical level, really just comes from, I think, a lot of the mentorship that I've received over the years. There were some folks, active duty officers in ROTC, that were extremely influential in helping me learn how to communicate with others, how to love others and consider them more important than myself. And I think a lot of those qualities, I'm certainly not a master of any of them, but I aspire to be better every day. And I think that to answer the second part of your question, how you do that technically, it's almost like a left and right brain conversation, like everything that I just said. Now, quick, switch over to how are you leading your team to have proper coding standards and implement Kubernetes manifest files in the way that they should be? I don't know. I'm just picking something random. It seems like those things are disconnected. But really, in the end of the day, they're extremely connected. Because at the end of the day, people are how we get the job done. We're always working with other people. And I think the temptation is when you're diving into the technical, when you're diving into, I guess, the right brain, would we call that the right brain side of things? Yeah, I don't know either. Whatever side of the brain is supposedly more technical, it's so easy to lose sight of the fact that we still are on a team with people who have whole lives and whole contexts and have stories. And it's just so easy to forget those things because the technical challenges can be extremely hard. Like a lot of the things that we're working on here at the 90th are, they're very deep just by nature of the types of missions that we're supporting are extremely technical. And I oftentimes make that mistake. I can be so buried in the code that I often forget to ask other people on my team, like how they're doing or to remember seemingly insignificant details about them. Emphasis on the seemingly, like remembering people's names is a great example. I've often met leaders who seem somehow like to be able to remember everybody's name and get it right every single time. And to remember the seemingly intricate details of others, those are some things that I feel like really help build rapport and give you the opportunity to speak into other people's lives. And so they're more willing to listen when you have an idea that you want to share or a desire to establish a vision to rally the team behind and move forward and actually create some progress.
Do you think if you've shown someone that like you care about them as a human, that it helps to have maybe even like a technical disagreement? Because at that point, like your identity isn't wrapped up in the technical decision. It's wrapped up in everything else that like you've shown that you care about.
Yeah. Yes, definitely. We just experienced this on the team. We had a very heated discussion where we all came together and agreed that we wouldn't leave the room until we had consensus, which can sometimes be dangerous. Sometimes that's not the right approach. In this approach, we're a small team. We're getting bigger. I can talk more about that later. But our team of four or five at the time, we just felt like it was very important to have that consensus before we left the room. And it was down to me and another individual contributor on the team. I'm the tech lead for my team. It was the role on the development team that I'm currently with. We were just butting heads. But yeah, I think once you have established that you care for this person and that's the bedrock that the relationship and the team dynamics are laid upon, that really frees you up to challenge each other's ideas and to really, I think, actually innovate and disrupt change and create change and whatever the task might be.
You mentioned your team a little. I'm curious if you're able to share what you were arguing about. And then I'm also curious to learn a little bit more about what your team does.
Sure. Yeah. We'll definitely dive into the technical weeds here a little bit. So my team, we're called Team Mario. We all receive like kind of these monikers, these designations here at the 90th. And our team is Team Mario. We're called that because we work with CI/CD pipelines primarily. The 90th is on the up and up with adopting DevOps technologies. And as that's something that they're starting to do and incorporate into their development lifecycle practices, our team formed around 8 to 10 months ago to serve as a catalyst for that. I think ideally, your software development organization wouldn't have a DevOps team because all of your developers would be doing DevOps. And I think that's truly the place that we're headed. But to help realize that vision sooner, we've decided that having this team kind of partner alongside each team and work on a particular project is the way to go for now. And our team right now is one of the value streams that we're providing to the 90th and to other cyber capability development organizations is primarily through what's called the CI/CD catalog in GitLab. It's a brand new feature. For those that are using GitLab, you're probably aware that you can include modular components into your pipeline, into your project's pipeline. GitLab provides many of these to customers who use GitLab, but we can actually create and ship our own. So we've started to create a collection of CI/CD components that are published to the catalog and help dev teams incorporate infrastructure automation into their CI/CD pipelines so that they can run functional tests in an automated fashion. And we're using technologies like Terragrunt and Terraform, Ansible, to automate a lot of manual processes that development teams are doing so that when they go to push their code to the centralized code repository, an automated series of functional tests are being performed on the code in a representative fashion of the intended effect that they're trying to produce with their capability. Our team started publishing these components about 3 or 4 months ago. It's a brand new feature with GitLab. I think it's still in beta, actually. It's just about to become, if it hasn't already, a generally available product. And we were arguing about like how many of these components are we gonna create? Like, where do we draw the abstraction layer? I was coming from the position that perhaps we should have a core collection of maybe 3 or 4, maybe a component that creates infrastructure, a component that allows you to run the configuration of that infrastructure to get it to a state that you need it to, and then maybe a few other components. And the other team member felt very strongly that, no, we should try to abstract as much as we can. And if that means a lot of our components are duplicated on an order of 70 or 80%, if there's a lot of shared code there, it doesn't matter because anybody can come to our catalog and essentially take a book off the shelf and use that component, even if it's slightly or majorly like another component. And so it's the dry principle, do not repeat yourself. And there's a great resource called Grugbrain, grugbrain.dev, that shows a little chart. I know you've read it, it's great. There's a little chart that shows code readability and the dry principle. And for those who are maybe listening and not able to see the screen, essentially there's an inflection point at some point in your career as a developer where you begin to prioritize the readability over the dryness. So it's some of these things that are on the minds of us members of the team of Team Mario. And we're philosophically sometimes disagreeing about this. And the thing is, there's no real right answer. There might be a preferential answer, or depending on which blog you read, there might be a right answer. But really for the team, it's up to the team. And so we decided, I guess, to put a cap on this discussion about components, we decided that we would establish some criteria, some eligibility criteria for when it comes time to make a new component. So we agreed we're going to maintain a collection of 2 or 3 components that we will use to build out customer pipelines for each project. But if we find that we're replicating a pattern across projects, if we do it more than twice is our current criteria, the third time we're gonna actually create a customized component so that we're starting to see enough of a trend that perhaps maybe this team or other teams could actually accept that abstraction layer at a higher level. And honestly, I think that's a better solution than I could have come up with on my own, than the other person could have come up with on their own. And I think that's the beauty of working in a team and really listening to one another and agreeing on a solution together.
So I'm going to ask you a question that I have heard a senior officer in the Air Force ask you. And I have a feeling it made you mad, but you didn't show it at the time. So I'm going to ask the same question right now, which is, once you finish this pipeline, do you just put all the capabilities through it?
Yeah. Oh man, I think what you're getting at is this reoccurring motif you keep hearing, which is where is the pipeline, quote unquote, the pipeline, capital T, capital P. And I think, man, it's so interesting. For some organizations, there will be a pipeline or the pipeline. I think of one of the value streams, their Platform One, their Party Bus product, the ability to deploy web applications or full stack applications all the way to prod is going to necessitate more or less a universal pipeline to deploy to production. But at the 90th, we're building bespoke capabilities. And we were just talking about this today in our sprint retro earlier this morning. We have a new member of the team and he's asking questions like, why don't we just create a one size fits all? Why don't we create the pipeline? And another member of the team says, we've never seen two projects the same. We've never seen two projects that are using anything close to the same pipeline. They use similar components. And so that's where this whole idea of the abstraction layer really helps, because if you draw the abstraction layer a little bit further down, there is a pipeline. Like, all projects will use a pipeline, and they may use similar pieces in that pipeline, similar fixtures. I've heard somebody use that word. I'm not a huge fan of the word fixtures. I don't know why, but I like the idea of components better. These components may look similar, but the way that you're organizing them, the way that the dependency flow and concurrency is working, it's extremely variable between the different projects that we're working on.
I think we talked a little bit about like technical leadership within your team. One of the concepts I've heard you discuss before is like around clarity and how you get senior leaders to do the things that you wish they would do without, I don't know, getting yourself into too much trouble. You mind kind of sharing your thoughts on like how you provide clarity to people who maybe don't even have the technical insights at all about what you're working on and why what you're asking them to do is important?
Yeah, man, that's a good question. I think brevity is key. Maybe just start there. I think a lot of times I will see email traffic from folks or messages or documentation, and the eyes glaze over, man. I just, you know, it's like, I can't remember where I heard this. Maybe it was a college class or, I don't know, another officer or something. Somebody's like, nobody wants to read your email. Like, nobody wants to read. I think there's an idea behind, isn't it the Amazon 5-pager or something, or 3-pager? I might be off by a couple pages.
I think it's a 6-pager, but yes.
A six pager. I think we were actually talking about this once when I was, and I'll be honest, like, what about a 1-pager? Let's just start there. Maybe even half a page. Like, I think folks are really, you know, their expectations are off when they think about an argument or a proposal for an idea that they want to put forward to leadership. They may go and draft a 5-6-page document. It's too much. It's too much. Like, I think our leaders are oftentimes just being pulled in so many different directions. We really need to, I think, start with an assertion that's very basic, where brevity is key, and, you know, really pack a punch in just a few sentences or maybe even a couple of paragraphs for the thing that we're trying to change. The humility of a question is often underrated. I think oftentimes just even asking leaders a simple question like, I don't know if this is a good time to bring up the whole CNAME flattening thing. I don't know if you wanted to get into that at all or...
You're welcome to.
Okay. There's this, the DNS spec dates back to the 1980s, and there's an RFC, I think it's RFC 10, 1035 or something, that talks about having CNAMEs at the apex of a domain. That's okay. What the heck does that mean? DNS is essentially like a labeling system for humans. When you go to google.com, right? You're getting an IP address. And so in the background, that translation's happening. And so there's a specification in the RFC that basically says you can't take, or you shouldn't, not you can't, but you shouldn't, take a domain name and point it to another domain name, essentially. Because then that domain name could point to another domain name, et cetera. And it's like, where is this thing actually going to resolve? And Cloudflare published a blog post about this years ago, where they basically turned this thing on its head, and they actually provide a service called CNAME flattening for their customers. It's actually very common. It's not just a Cloudflare thing. Google does this. GoDaddy does this. Anywhere you host a domain now does this, except for the DoD. We do not do this because we don't subscribe to what we would consider breaking changes of the RFC. And if you go to our squadron's website, you're required to type in www.shadowsedge.mil. And again, there's nothing wrong with this according to the RFC. In fact, that's the way it should be. According to the RFC, you shouldn't be able to type in shadowsedge.mil and get redirected to a CNAME. We could set up an IP address and throw a 301 direct on there anyway, but ideally, if we were hosting our DNS with anybody else, we'd be able to do this. We'd be able to make it so that you don't have to type in that stupid subdomain. And you might think this is trivial, but oftentimes, like, it's not. People ask, you might just overhear the URL, or somebody might tell you to go to it, and you oftentimes don't include that www part, and it works just fine.
To be completely honest, I never type www, and then I assume that the website doesn't work if it doesn't show up. At least I did before this, and then I unlearned everything, and now I still don't type www unless it doesn't work.
Yeah. And so we got the website set up. That happened while I was here at the 90th. It was actually a product of one of our hackathon, kind of internal hackathon events here at the squadron. But we had that stupid subdomain that we had to enter. And I asked the question to a few people in the various chains of command, and it turned into this whole thing. It really did. It turned into this whole thing. And thankfully, my squadron leadership had my back, and the wing commander had my back even. He even stepped in and said, this is exactly what we want. our lieutenants to be doing is asking these types of questions. But it was just amazing to me to see how there was so much blowback from just a simple question, right? I didn't write a 6-page proposal for this is why we should adopt CNAME flattening. Just the question, like, why haven't we? Everybody else has done this. Why is this not something we've done? It's just fascinating to see the sparks fly. And you have to be careful because you're not trying to challenge anybody's authority, I think, is the difference. It's a fine line. Disruption is a fine line. But I think ultimately, when you're asking from a place of humility and trying to be curious but not judgmental, the Walt Whitman quote, that's great. It's great. I think that is ultimately should be the guiding light for how you're trying to affect change from the front lines.
I feel like you've given us the perfect segue into your title at the 90th, which is Chief Disruption Officer. The first thing I'm curious about is that your real title? And then from there, like, how?
Yes, so it is. It's actually my real title. If I were to pull VMPF up or whatever, AFPC, MIL-PDS, whatever, I don't know what all these systems are called. But it's in there, sure is. It was cyber capabilities developer, and then sure enough, there's Chief Disruption Officer as of last month, I think. The new squadron commander had mentioned it in passing, semi-jokingly, a few months back, because there's no duty title requirement for my particular career field. As a 17 Sierra, I guess we can have any duty title that the commander or whoever deems appropriate. And the boss man brought this up and was joking about it a little bit, and then he brought it up several weeks later. And he brought it up again. And I was like, sir, if you want to do it, let's do it. Like, we should do it. And he was like, would you like that? Or you want to do it? And I was like, sure, let's change it. And he's like, all right, route the paperwork. Let's make it happen. And, you know, after the fact, you know, really started to think about it. And I think he would probably say the same. You know, it's half jokingly, but half seriously. I think his reasoning behind it is just a designation to recognize that this is something that we need at our squadron. We need someone who's willing to swim upstream and ask these challenging questions. If you were to Google what's the definition for disruption, you're most likely to get a verb back, or like basically to disrupt. We think we know what that means, but if you were to look at Webster's 1828 dictionary, which is a frequently referenced dictionary of mine, it's his original work, Noah Webster's, there's some crazy things in there. You think you know what a word means, and then you read Webster's 1828 and you're wrong. There, it talks about it's an adjective to tear, a disrupt, or I guess that would be a noun. I don't know. Grammar is hard. If you Google it, Webster's 1828, you'll see that essentially there's this idea of tearing or like ripping the fabric of something. And it's like, man, what? Is that what this means? And I actually think that's probably more on point. It's like cutting through, I think, a lot of our assumptions to just ask questions. And I think that's what disruption means to me, is always trying to be sure that we're intentional about the decisions we've made instead of unintentional. Disruption doesn't always mean innovation. It doesn't always mean something new. It could be a reformation of something we've decided is foundational to the mission or to what we're doing, but isn't intentional. Is what we've established the status quo because it's the best thing? Like sometimes the status quo is good. But doing things for just doing things' sake, like this is the way things have always been done, that's pretty dangerous. That can get very dangerous very quickly.
What you're saying, Captain, is that you're just going to come in and change things for no good reason just to mess everything up. Is that track? Is that what you're thinking your duty title is all about?
No, I hope not. Yeah, changing things for changing, and I know you're joking, changing things for changing things' sake is also dangerous. There's a great book called The Innovation Delusion that talks about this. And basically the hypothesis of the book is like, innovation is an overly used word. That's an understatement for sure. You see it everywhere. And really the book goes on to argue about maintenance and how maintenance is more important than innovation. It's very interesting. But that book was the first thing to me that communicated that idea of there are a lot of people out there changing things just to change them. And that's also a dangerous place to be. I'd say that's maybe even more dangerous than the status quo, because the status quo at least is knowable, is understandable and traceable. But man, to just get in there and wreak havoc, I don't think that's what disruption is either.
I don't think so, but I wanted to give you an opportunity to defend that viewpoint.
Sure.
Because I do know, having spent some time in the Air Force myself, like, there are a lot of people who get really uncomfortable, both from, you talk about asking questions, like questions make people uncomfortable. And I can't tell you how many times, like, I'd ask a question and someone took it as direction. I'm just like, oh, hey, why are we doing it that way? And I would see an email go out, Rebecca wants us to do this differently. Those weren't my words. Like, how do you protect? Do you think that's something that should be protected against? Or like, how do you approach that problem of being seen as a rebel just because you want to be a rebel? Or do you just love it? In which case, that's awesome too.
I think you have to be very confident about your intentions. And that's hard because I think sometimes we don't even really know our intentions. I think that sometimes it requires you to have wise counsel, close friends, close peers at work that you really trust. And sometimes need that verification or that double check on, because I think I know if it's a spectrum for me, if the extreme left is going to be someone who's always on the status quo, never changing anything, and the extreme right is being changing things all the time for no reason, I know I'm going to probably be pulled more towards the right, be pulled more towards that always changing things. And I think it helps to have those people who are close to you and can help ask those challenging questions of you. When I was at tech school, I wanted to meet with the squadron commander of the schoolhouse to share a project I had worked on. I forget why. I think I was trying to submit for some innovation roundup or something. There's that word again. And my mentor at the time was like, why do you want to do this? Do you actually want to submit for this? Or are you just trying to get up close and personal with the boss? And what is your real intention for doing this? Ooh, that's good. Like, thanks for asking that question. There's definitely some of that going on there. And so I think that's what it comes down to. Are you going to have people who are going to disrupt you so that you can continue to keep disrupting the system?
I think that's an awesome answer. You've had a very different career than I think even most like 17 Sierra officers up to this point. But definitely, I think definitely different than the average Air Force officer. Given like the ROTC background, the time you spent recruiting, which I think probably gives you some insights that are broader than a lot of other officers have into what kids these days are considering when they're thinking about whether or not to go into ROTC or whether or not to go into ROTC and whether or not to join the military. Like, what advice would you have for someone who wants to write software for the DoD as an officer?
I think my advice would be that you can make it happen if you try hard enough. That's not always true. Sometimes we really want things to happen and they don't. And that can be disappointing when that happens. But I think for the most part, you know, this idea that any system, whether it's the Air Force or whether it's a large corporation or whatever, is impenetrable, this impenetrable fortress that everybody's got rules that they've written and they subscribe to. And, you know, it's just impossible for you to try to navigate a path that will afford you opportunities to bring your skills and your talents to contribute to the mission. Like, that's like sometimes our default perspective, because it is hard. It takes a lot of work. And it's scary sometimes to try to navigate the unknown. But you start to realize, I heard somebody say this the other day, all words are made up. Like, all words that we're speaking right now they're made up. And really, so are our structures that we're a part of. There's no real, like, divine decree that comes down and says that the Air Force must be constructed in this way. Certainly there are rules and regulations that have brought about the structure, but really, like, we have to boil it down. Again, it's the same idea of the six pager down to maybe a few sentences. What is the point of the DoD? Like, we're here to serve and protect the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic. And like, domestic, we got to think about that. Sometimes we're our biggest enemy. So I think that when you really boil it down and you think about what the fuel is for the reason that this whole thing exists, and you make that your rocket fuel, you'll find that the system actually it should be set up to support that vision. And so you can take that and use that to your own advantage into finding opportunities that allow you to contribute back to the mission and making your why, your personal why, the Air Force's how.
Yeah, that is like literally the best answer I could have imagined. Actually, no, it's not. It's better than what I could have imagined, which is awesome. So thank you. I love that. What closing note would you hope that we ended it on? What thoughts would you love to share that close us out?
Man, just appreciation for software. Maybe that's like a weird thing to say, but as we're talking about like all...
That is so not a weird thing to say. I think software is incredible. So let's do it.
It is. Yeah, it is. Software, like by its own nature, is a disruptive medium. I think it's so amazing how all of this recent AI craze, maybe even AI bubble, or I don't know what you want to call it, but it's really a whole lot of it's not much new. There's not a whole lot of things that are new, but it's this compounding kind of inertia on maybe new projects like ChatGPT or Llama or whatever, any of these Mistral, any of these open models, even the stuff that you guys are doing at Defense Unicorns. A lot of it behind the scenes is not extremely new technology. It's been around for a little while. It's just maybe reapplied. And I think it's just so fascinating how being able to contribute in an open source community, having global participants from all around the world build things together that's literally coming out of their brains onto the screen. Like, that's code is, your limitations are truly oftentimes, I think, just how smart you are or how smart your team is. It's just crazy that you can go from 0 to 100 just writing some words on a screen. I think that's just insane. And so when I think about my experience here at the 90th and my experience in the Air Force overall, I think that is the real value of software development, is that it affords you a medium to actually disrupt things. And I'm just thankful for communities that are continuing to push the boundaries of what we know is possible and push the boundaries for what we believe is, like, what we're capable of.
I love that. Thank you so much for your time today and for sharing your perspective. I think yours is one I haven't seen us have on the podcast yet, but I love that you could share your perspective. So thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, thank you for having me. It's been an honor and I really appreciate it.
This is your host, Rebecca Lively. Thanks for listening to Defense Unicorns, a podcast. We have amazing guests coming the next couple of episodes, so subscribe now so you get notified when we release new content.